Good afternoon. So last time we went over kind of an introduction to what we'd be covering in this course for kind of our main themes. So we'd be covering sort of automating building programs in informational compilation. So you learn to like how to build programs manually in CS01. We're going to automate that a little bit as our first topic. And we have these kind of more ambitious conceptual goals dealing with how we can effectively share machines. So moving beyond our very simplified CPU model that we had in CS01, where basically we can only run one program at a time, to something where we can share a machine with multiple programs and multiple users, and we can potentially have machines that do multiple things at a time. And we also mentioned we'll be talking a bit about connecting machines together and what goes on under the hood of that. We also spent a bit of time reviewing pointers in C, and we're gonna do a little bit extra of that and then go on to building today. And because I was bad at timing things, we didn't finish going over logistics, so that's what I'm gonna start with today. But before I do that, any questions about things we covered, talked about last time? Okay. So logistics, some of this I went over. So there's two sections. We should basically be the same except for lectures. We'll try to stay in sync. And we have labs, which you can attend in person and get checked off, or you can submit. Submission might have stricter grading. And some labs will require attendance, effectively, or you need to get a special exception with us because the lab logistically, like, needs you to be there. Like, having you give people feedback on their code in person is not something you can do on your own, for example. And if you can't make a lab, you can let me know. This applies even if the lab is submittable. You might be able to do something about that. You can collaborate on labs, but please indicate who you're working with and what you submit, or, you know, to the TAs who are checking you off. We'll have homework assignments that are individually generally due on Fridays, and there's not a Our first assignment is a warm-up assignment for doing some C stuff. You're going to write a C function to split a string into an array of strings with dynamic memory allocation for that new array and all the strings in it, and write a C program that will call that function with specified input and command line stuff, and write a make file for it. The first two items you should be able to do as of when you finish CS01. In theory. So you can get started on that now, especially if you think you need to review C. That would be a good idea. The makefile part, we're going to start covering that today. We'll also have these quizzes, which will release after the Thursday lecture starting next week, not this week. And they'll do be 15 minutes before. Right, I need to keep editing this slide. Why did I not remember to do that? Before. First, sure, so I should emphasize this. Before the 12:30 p.m. lecture, the other lecture, because it doesn't make sense for you to be working on the quiz while Skadron is explaining the quiz answers in Rice 130, which anyone could walk into. So you then, and these are individual open book, open notes, open internet, untimed, and we'll go through what the way interface for doing it, but it's unlimited submissions. Whatever you last submitted is what we grade. The quizzes have a place for comments and works. They will be mostly auto-graded because I do not have the time to like actually look through 400 times 5 answers every week, even with a lot of TAs who, but we will read comments and work on quizzes, and if you want partial credit on anything, I would recommend using them. Because if we don't see it in what you submit, we can't give you partial credit for it, but if you, you know, If we do, we can. Sometimes we make mistakes in quizzes because we're writing new quizzes every semester, because we recognize the reality that you have access to the prior semester's quizzes, whether we give it to you or not. So we just give it to you. It's on the study materials tab on the webpage, all the prior quizzes. But that means that, you know, these quiz questions might have things we missed. So if you find a possible error in a quiz question, make your best guess and explain what you did in the comments. We generally can't answer questions about the quiz questions while they're out. The biggest issue is that if you contact me Saturday about a quiz question being bad, well, first of all, I might be doing something on the weekend, and secondly, some people may have decided to take the quiz on Friday because they have lots of stuff to do on the weekend and Monday, and I don't want to tell them, sorry, too bad, you shouldn't have done it early. So what we'll do instead, for the, and most of the time, is we'll just deal with it when grading. If we have to drop a quiz question, we have to drop a quiz question. If we have to accept a whole bunch of extra answers, we'll accept a whole bunch of extra answers. But we're not going to usually be able to answer clarifying questions. So just like tell us what you were thinking, think we meant, or why the question doesn't make sense, and we can read those comments and adjust your score appropriately, or decide to change how the question is graded for everyone appropriately. On help on quiz questions. So I, you know, if you go to my office hours on Friday and ask me a quiz question, well, not this week, but in some future week, I'm obviously not just going to tell you the answer to the quiz question that's out, but I'm happy to talk about any of the lecture material, any of the examples in lecture, quizzes from prior semesters, other things that might be related, but, you know, just, you know, not the quiz question itself. And generally, the TAs are responsible for knowing what they can and can't answer, though please don't abuse that, you know. No one who's an instructor or TA likes the student who is trying to do everything, trying to get the answer and nothing else. And, you know, that's something we can't give you, but we can help you actually understand the question. Like, all that stuff is fair game. And we can go through even possibly similar examples, you know, just not the actual scenario in the questions. And I, in the past, have gone over quiz questions in lecture. I won't always do it. You can always ask about it in office hours or on Piazza, and we'll, you know, if I don't, you know, just because I don't go over in lecture doesn't mean I won't talk about it. So questions about quizzes besides, like, what the quiz interface looks like, which we'll cover before the next quiz next week. Okay. In lieu of a textbook, we have readings. Most of the readings were written by Professor Tokanovich, revised by me, and maybe they'll be revised by Skoudrin throughout the semester. They're on the website and should be indicated in the corresponding lecture. If not, there's the index page of the website links to all these readings. The readings often link supplementary material at the end, so if you want someone else's writing because you think our writing is horribly uninformative and unreadable, sometimes, you know, depending on the topic, we found, like, there's some other text, online textbooks that are well-written for that topic that you can point you to for an additional perspective or more information. And if that doesn't work, sometimes I can find you additional resources if you don't like what the readings say. Depends on the topic. Our lecture and assignments may be out of sync. I'm just telling you this because, you know, we've played scheduling Tetris. But sometimes we'll cover something in lecture, and 2 weeks later, the homework for it will be just because of how the schedule, you know, you have to put assignments somewhere, and that doesn't necessarily mask the pace at which we cover things in lecture or in lab. So there's one final exam in person, and there are no midterms. That's why the quizzes count as much as they do. I think most people like that compromise. I mostly like that compromise, but that's why the quizzes are so much. Development environment. So we will test your code for any assignments that involve code or something like that via something similar to SSHing into Portal and running it. So if it doesn't run in that type of environment, you know, it's not, we might not give you credit for it. But we don't require any particular development environment. So if you want to use whatever IDE you want to use, that's fine with us. It just needs to work when we test it by, you know, running it on something like Portal via SSH. So you probably should know how to do that and probably should do that, but you can use whatever development environment you're comfortable with. Many students in the past have had success using VS Code plus its SSH support to actually run things on Portal but use VS Code, so that's a reasonable option. I don't use VS Code, so I probably can't give you great help on that. What we've heard from TAs in the past is that you can use SSH to run on Portal. There's probably a tutorial in some 2130 stuff. You probably should install the C and C++ extension, and the Make File Tools extension are both useful for this class if you happen to be using VS Code. But as I said, we're testing by SSH into Portal. If it doesn't work there, as far as we're concerned, it doesn't work. For getting help, there will be office hours posted on the website. We are working to get our TAs to fill in the office hour calendar starting next week, probably around and after the first lab. There will probably be some remote office hours, probably mostly at times where we expect it makes less sense for you to go to Rice Hall or where we can't get a room. And probably mostly in-person office hours. We may use an online queue for the remote ones. We might use it for the in-person ones or not. Just look for, the TA should have something written on a whiteboard or similar in the whatever room the office hours are in. We have a Piazza, which is my preferred way for asynchronous general questions. You can ask private questions there if you want to ask a question that's like specific to your code that you couldn't share with the class. And that's fine. And you can also email me, preferably with the course number and the subject, so I file your email correctly. That might not be the promptest way to get help. And I guess I note that I expect some office hours will be busy. Our TAs have been told that their job is not to debug your code. Your job is to debug your code. They can help you debug, but you know, we can't have TAs spending 20 minutes staring at your code while five people are waiting to get TA help. Yeah, it's just not a thing we can do. And collaboration policy briefly. So I mentioned labs, you can work with partners. Homeworks, you may not. In fact, your code should be your own. You can ask conceptual questions. You know, questions where the answers will probably not be code or pseudocode. Of others, and you should cite sources you use, preferably in comments in the code if you get anything extraordinary from somewhere. Quizzes are individual, but they're open book, open notes, etc. Just don't like ask the quiz question somewhere. Don't look for a Stack Overflow question. That's exactly the quiz question. Yeah. That sort of thing. There's anonymous feedback on Canvas. There's a tool. I appreciate feedback, especially when it's feedback I can do something about. You can also put rants there, but they probably won't do much, and I don't know how Skadron will feel about that. I don't mind it, but Skadron might. It's not a good way to ask for regrades or things like that. We occasionally see that. You know, it's anonymous, I won't know who you are, I can't fix your quiz grade if you put it in anonymous feedback. It's not good. Late policy. So, there are no late quizzes because we may discuss the quiz in lecture and also the answers are released automatically. We will unconditionally, no questions asked, drop one quiz. For homeworks, you can submit them between 0 and 72 hours late for 90% credits. No questions asked. If it's submitted more than 72 hours late, that's 0% credits. For labs that allow submission, ones that can be submitted. They are due 11:59 a.m. the Thursday, so the day after the lab. We will not check them off late, but you can submit them late for their slightly more stringent grading than a checkoff. And you can submit them 0 to 24 hours late for 90% credit. More than 24 hours late is 0%. If you have some special circumstances, usually I can make exceptions to those policies, but you need to actually contact me in some way. And please don't attend lab when sick. We can figure something else out. But for that. And on attendance, I won't take attendance in lecture. I will attempt to have lecture recordings, but sometimes things happen. So I'm not going to guarantee there's lecture recordings, but there should be generally. And yeah, so any questions about logistics before we do a little bit more C review stuff? Yes? Does the other professor also record their lectures? Yes. Well, at least attempt to record their lectures. Yes. Yeah. Where's the Discord link? It is not posted yet. For my logistics, I have it available to the TAs so I can more easily set them up on the Discord before it's open to everyone else. Other questions? Okay. So, some of you might need or want to review C. So some options, potential options. I forgot, I have a better version of this slide. Yes. Some potential options are some exercises we've used in the past is that, I guess I should start with here. So their CSO1 stuff is, if you've taken CSO1, that's probably a good place to start. If even if you haven't, you can look at labs 9 through 12 from last fall and probably this spring. And those would be a good thing to go through. In the past, when we've had to do C refreshers, some other exercises we've used are implementing StringSep and doing a conversion from a dynamic array to a linked list, just for practice in C. And Skadrin, when he taught OS previously, he also made his own C refreshers, and those are posted in Canvas under files. So those are some potential resources for those of you who need to review C stuff. And I'll go through some little pointer things just as a number. So here I have some C code where I have an array of integers, an integer, and a pointer. And these are going to be put in memory in some way. So in this example, the array happens to be at address 2C here and goes up to 3, 8. Then we have at 2.8, we have the signal, and we have pointer. And if I just assign a number to the pointer, dereferencing it, that doesn't work. And I'm mentioning this because this is something I see people do in the warm-up assignment. Why doesn't that work? Anyone? Why do I have that marked as runtime error? Yeah, back there. So, because I'm changing some arbitrary spot in memory, yes. So why is it arbitrary? Well, I didn't say, what value this pointer has. So it just has something there from wherever the compiler decided to place it. And what I am saying to do with this line is modify that question mark location and put the value AB in it. And hopefully, that will be a runtime error. If we're unlucky, it might not be a runtime error. And instead, if we're really unlucky, this question mark might be, something important. And we'll have something more complicated than a runtime error going on, if we're unlucky. But usually we'll have a runtime error because the question mark value will cause a segmentation fault or something like that. And for assigning a pointer, If we want to have a pointer value, we can sort of assign a pointer by using the address of operator. So in this case, I'm assigning it to the address of single. And it happens that the way my compiler laid out memory signals an address 0x28. And if I knew that somehow, which normally I wouldn't, I could sort of manually do what the compiler is doing when I write at single by writing that address and converting it to a pointer. Note that that's very different than the example I started with of like dereferencing the pointer and setting it to that. That is very much not the same thing, right? With this pointer equals, I'm changing where the pointer points. I'm not doing anything with where the pointer used to point. If I write star pointer, I'm using where the pointer points now. And here I kind of indicated that after this runs, the pointer will contain 0x28. If we're kind of doing our box diagram, we'd say, you know, it points to signal. That's how it's going to be represented kind of in memory in this case. So some things that are not equivalent to this is, so one thing I might try to do is I'd say, well, I have this cache, do I really need that? And hopefully that's a compile error. So it says compile error, I would say sometimes compile error, you know, and you should make it one. So sometimes this is just a warning. If it's just a warning, I encourage you to pretend it's an error, because usually something weird is happening if you accidentally do that. But that would be trying to assign the value. And if you just set the pointer equal to signal, even with a cast, that's not trying to do this. That's not going to do the same thing. What would that do? Well, signal in this case has the value 0x78, it would cross this out and write 0x78, and then our pointer would point to an unknown location again. And if we tried to dereference that pointer, we'd have the same problem we had in our first example. We're modifying something that hopefully is a seg fault. If we're unlucky, it might be something important and cause even a worse error. So questions on these pieces of pointer manipulation. I guess part of the reason I'm showing you this is that we're going to have an assignment later in this semester where we're going to need to deliberately convert from integers to pointers and vice versa. And for that reason, I want us to be, you know, comfortable with what that does and doesn't do. A problem I often see is people really want this pointer equals signal with appropriate cast to do the thing as taking the address of signal. They, you know, are not being careful about when do I have a value in a variable versus where that value is stored. And normally, the compiler is protecting you from that by requiring you to explicitly cast when you're making that distinction. And hopefully you make sure that happens, and that means that when you don't do it, it's a compile error telling you, you missed something here, probably. Right. And yes, so reviewing, for using a pointer, we can dereference a pointer, and we've seen that. So in this case, I have my pointer pointing to signal, I dereference it, it sets the value at signal is variable. I can set my pointer to point to an array, and there's a bunch of ways I could do that. They're all equivalent. All do the same thing. And But some things I can't do, right? I can't make the pointer point to the array by setting it equal to its first element. That's a value versus the location of that value disagreement. That's not going to work. When I have a pointer to an array, I can use it like an array. So the array indexing operator, as I mentioned last time, is shorthand for pointer arithmetic. We mentioned pointer arithmetic, uses the size of the thing pointed to. So these are kind of all ways of setting array of two to OXIF. So we can do it by, you know, taking, using pointer as if it were an array. We can take pointer and do add two to it to advance it by two elements and to reference that location. And we can kind of do this with explicit temporary pointers. It's all equivalent. Questions? This array indexing. Okay, so one other thing with pointers that is going to come up a bunch, and like both in this class and if you actually do C programming in your like a job, is that a very common pattern with pointers is that we have a function, we want to change one of its arguments. And the way things work in C, well, if I just have a function and assign to its argument, the argument is a local copy. We always pass by value in C. So the arguments are always copied. So in this example, we have x, which is passed by value. But what's the value of x? It's an address. So what we do here is we're passing the address of signal, and I'm not changing that address, I'm changing something at that address. So this is how I make a function that modifies the thing I pass to it. I don't actually pass the thing to modify, I pass a pointer to that thing. And very commonly, you'll see functions in like the C standard library and elsewhere where they want to modify something, but they don't want to return the modified value. They want you to pass in a pointer to the thing to modify. They might do this in lieu of returning a value, or very often, they want to like return two values. So like in a language like Python, you can like return a tuple. That's not really a thing in C. So a function which would might in Python return like a tuple will instead have one or more things where you pass a pointer for the function to dereference and modify the thing that pointer points to. And we, in fact, have an example of this pattern in our warm-up assignment, the function you have to implement. It returns an array and its size, but we can't actually return both of those things at the same time. So the prototype we have you implement, we return the array as the return value, but we pass the size in through a pointer, and you modify. We have a pointer to a place to store the size, and you modify that size that you get a pointer to. So questions about this pattern? Okay. So for the rest of our time, we'll talk about building and compilation. I guess I should check, because I'm really done with C review, so just really checking. Okay, so we're going to talk about building C programs. And we're going to look at like what files are involved. And I'm going to have my example here where I have a C program called program that has four source files. I have main.c and extra.c. And main.c includes some header files that are kind of local to my program of main.h and extra.h. And extra.c includes the header file extra.h. And also, like, I use printf in main and extra, apparently, or something like printf. So they include the system header file standard.io.h. And that means that when I'm building this program, you know, step by step, when I compile main.c and extra.c into object files, that main.o is going to be produced by the compiler reading main.c and main.h and extra.h and standard.io.h and doing something with those that all that stuff it reads and generating main.o, which will have like our machine code and so on for the functions and variables in main.c. And similarly, extra.o will be produced by taking the file, the stuff in extra.h, standard.io.h, and extra.c, producing machine code and such for those files. And you may remember from CSO2, there's kind of a hidden extra step here where there's like an assembly file that we usually don't like generate, but we could generate beforehand. So then we have these 2.0 files, and we combine them into a program. And here I'm doing that with Clang, and I'm passing this -o option. So the -o option, this means this is just set output file. So the -o option isn't what says to make an executable. It just says the output file is called program. So if I ran Clang main.o extra.o, this is the same, but the program is called a.out. So the .o minus o option just says, don't use the default output name of a.out, which is some old history. Use the name program. That's all that -o program does. Because Clang just looks at this and says, oh, it's a bunch of .o files. You must be making an executable. Let me do that. And our executable, as is indicated here, is main from main, extra, and some other files. You might say, wait, what other files do we need? And you might say, okay, it must be the file where standard.io is implemented. And the answer is no. That's in this libc thing we'll talk about in a bit. So the big other file we need is that it's going to be a CRT something.o that the compiler provides. And what this handles is that main secretly isn't where our program starts. So it looks like when you write a program in C, it starts in main. It doesn't really start in main when the system runs it. There's some code that the compiler provides that actually calls main. And this is necessary because we want to provide the right arguments to main, and we have to deal with what happens when main returns. If main returns, the program should exit normally. And it turns out the way that that's going to be handled is we have some code the compiler provides that was carefully written in assembly that calls main and runs when main returns because it called main. Where does main return to? Thing that called it. And that's going to be one of those system files that are linked in. So we produce this program that has our main.o, extra.o, and some stuff the compiler provides to make main work and maybe some other utility things the compiler needs, bits of assembly. And when we actually run our program at runtime, when we start our program, it's going to load this file on Linux called libc.so. And this is sort of the C standard library. And for example, this is where printf's code is. The declarations for printf were in standard.io.h. The actual code for printf is in libc.so. And that's loaded at runtime, and we'll talk about sort of why we do that in a bit. So questions on the scenario I'm showing here. So as the slide indicates, I've marked this as dynamic linking, and you might realize by remarking it that way, there must be something other than dynamic linking. So dynamic linking is this case where we're loading this library at runtime, and this is the default on all the systems you've used, especially for the C standard library. That by default, the way it works is that printf's code isn't in your program. It's loaded when your program runs, and the same for most of the other C-centered library functions. There's an alternative where we can instead do static linking, where we can put that code into your program directly, rather than loading it at runtime. And in that case, when we're producing our program, we'll also include an additional system file, which is going to be the library that has the actual machine code for printf and so on. And this method is called static linking. And on Linux, sort of this dot A represents a static library, or statically linked library, and our dot SO is a dynamic library, also known as a shared library. And you might say, what does SO stand for? It's shared object. And you can basically think of the .so file as kind of a funny .o file as far as what it contains. It's like a .o file, but instead of putting it in the executable, we're loading it later. So, question might be, why would we want to do this? What would be a reason to have it loaded at runtime rather than just putting it directly in our executable? What might be an advantage? Yes?
Can we put shared libraries in every executable? It increases the overall cost.
Yeah, so we'll have a pro here for dynamic linking is, you know, fewer copies of the standard library machine code on the system. So with this approach, there's one file, libc.so, that all the programs load. With the other approach, we've copied, like the code for printf, into every single executable we've made. So we might have thousands of copies of it on our system. So questions or additional things? Okay, additional things then?
I'd say also that if there's
changes to the library, it needs to be invested through the code. Okay, so yeah. So a pro and is that we can, you know, automatically get library changes. So if there's a bug in printf and it gets fixed, I don't need to rebuild all my programs. I just update libc.so, and now all my programs will never encounter that printf bug. Now, I've marked this as +/-, because this is also a disadvantage. If I update my printf in a way that's incompatible with the prior version and change libc.so, now suddenly some programs that might have worked before that rely on that what happened before printf was changed won't work. And that's kind of surprising and annoying. And if I update, say, you know, how printf is called, maybe they won't work in even a stronger way, we might have a seg fault or something because the assembly that calls printf is no longer correct because printf's prototype changed, for example. So that's a pro and a con for shared libraries, is that, you know, when we make changes, all the applications see them. Good for bug fixes, bad for updates that might not be compatible. So another kind of advantage, which we'll mention later in the semester, is we have fewer copies in memory. So we'll learn later in the semester that it's going to be possible for if we have 10 different programs all using libc.so, not only to only have one copy on disk, but to only have one copy of the library in memory while those programs are running. That this having it in a separate file makes it possible for the OS to arrange for us to not even duplicate the code in memory and save memory that way. That would be very hard to do if we had separate files with copies of it. Not impossible, but not really practical. Other sort of comments, questions? Yes? Would it be slower to inject the machine code at runtime? So, yeah, so that's another, that's a con here, is that, you know, sort of possibly slower to sort of start up. Start up and maybe to run. So it's gonna be possibly slower for startup because loading something at runtime where you have to deal with, you know, things potentially being different slightly each time as we update libc.so, that's going to be more complicated. It's going to probably be a more harder thing to do than loading just the code in the executable. And it can be slower. I say can be because it can be faster if it's already loaded, right? So for libc, you know, probably some other program loaded it, so it's already mostly loaded. But the process of setting it up is going to be more complicated. That's going to make startup time slower. And also, it turns out that usually the way shared libraries work, the process for calling a function in a shared library is more complicated at the assembly level, and that can be very slightly slower. Yes? Back there, yeah.
I'm sorry, what does it say after standard lib in the plus?
Standard lib machine code. Yes, what does it say after standard lib was the question. Yes, your question?
So if someone was to maliciously change libc.so, would that probably like affect every program that loads at runtime?
The question is, if someone changed libc.so, would that affect every program that loads it at runtime? Yes. Generally, you know, the libraries that are shared among all users will be only controlled by the system administrator. And we usually don't consider this like a disadvantage of shared libraries because if you can change libc.so, like you can change like ls. And that's probably about as bad. Other questions? Yeah. Subset of, what is the subset, where? What? Possibly slower to start up and run. Positive, oh, here? This? That's fewer copies in memory. Sorry. I need to be slower at handwriting. Do copies in other questions, comments? Okay. So we have these two types of libraries, and I've shown you kind of how things work on Linux. If you're using other OSs, the file extensions may be different. So these file extensions here are the ones you'll usually see on Windows, not always. This is a file extension you may see on OS X. Something that might not be intuitive if you're used to Windows is on Unix and Linux-like machines, traditionally executables have no extensions. Questions? Okay, extensions. So let's talk about how we can produce libraries, which is going to be something we're going to do in the lab next week. So on Unix, libraries have a name like libfoo.a. So .a is our extension, and usually, by convention, this lib is actually part of the name. If I have a library foo, I'll call it libfoo.a, not foo.a. Like, yes, you can name it foo.a, but the compiler kind of is built assuming you start the name with lib and end it with .a. And this is an archive file. That's where the name .a comes from. So it's actually built off kind of an old version of an archive tool that kind of became the standard for this. You know, an archive tool, I mean something like zip. It's not zip, it's something older than zip called AR, the standard archive tool, because at the time it was the archive tool. And it's literally just an archive, like a zip file of the .o files, with an index for the compiler to find the right .o files for what you're doing. And you can create one with the AR command, and usually you'll provide these options, RCS, the R says to make the index, the R says to update, the C says to create if it doesn't exist, and the S says to make an index, so the compiler can find the right .o files in it. And you'll say what .a file you want to create and all the .o files you want to put or update in it. And the way this literally works is it's just packaging the .o files together into one file, you know, and it's going to be kind of similar to if you just specified all these .o files when you use the library later. And then later on, you invoke your compiler. I've used CC here to indicate any compiler, Clang, GCC, whatever compiler you use. And you specify two different types of options for the library. So the main option you're going to specify is this dash lowercase l and the library name. So in this case, our library name is foo, which means the file is named libfoo.a. So note that the lib doesn't appear there, just as lfoo, and that says to look for libfoo.a. But you may say, where do we look for it? And there's some default locations where the compiler looks for libraries, which would be where a system administrator would install a library for everyone to use. But if your library is not one of those, if it's not installed by the system administrator for everyone, you'll have to tell the compiler where to find it. And the way you do that is with this is dash capital L option, where you specify where the library is. So the assumption here is that the library would be in slash path to libfoo.a. Questions on this command? Yeah. What does the RCS stand for? So the R is update, the C is create, and the S is sort of the update index, I believe. If you actually need to know this, you should read the man page, rather than, you know, this is not, I'm giving you a working example, but if you need to know how to use AR, read the manual page, that will tell you what things actually do and be more correct than me. Yes?
So if you wanted to bundle in with c.a, you just do hyphen l c, and that would bundle it.
So the question is, if I wanted to include libc.a, I could just do hyphen l c. So, kind of. So there's two issues there. So one is that by default, the compiler includes libc when you compile. That's kind of redundant with the defaults for the compiler. And it includes it because, well, you use printf and you don't specify any options, so it's just there by default. The other reason is, as we'll talk about on the next slide, the dash L option is actually agnostic to whether it's a shared or a static library. What's going to happen is the compiler will look for one of them and use what's available, basically. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So this is static libraries. So shared libraries have a name on Linux, like lib. Again, we have that lib prefix, and then the name of the library, so in this case, foo, and then .so for a shared object. And if I say shared libraries, this is the exact same thing for our purposes as dynamic libraries or dynamically linked libraries. These are all terms you might see that mean the same thing. And to make one of those, there's some extra steps to make them, and we'll also see there's some extra steps for using them. So when making them, we have to compile our .o files differently. And on Linux, we're going to do that with, I guess most compilers, we're going to do that with this FPIC flag, where PIC stands for position independent code. So our libraries, when we generate the assembly for them, the assembly needs to handle that the library can be loaded at different locations in memory. So our machine code needs to be something that we can load at one place in memory or another. When we're making executables, we can rely on the OS always loading that at a specific location for us, or at least a more constrained set of locations, so we have more flexibility in the machine code that we generate. The FPIC option tells the compiler, I need this to be loadable anywhere in memory because presumably it's part of a shared library. It could be loaded by multiple programs in different ways. So once we've compiled our .o files correctly, then rather than using an archive utility, we'll use our compiler front end, and we'll pass this -shared option to indicate we want a shared library, and otherwise it will look like we're making an executable. You know, the command line will be the same, but we're going to produce a shared library instead of an executable. Then later on, to use this shared library, these instructions, superficially, look exactly the same as libfoo.a. So the compiler will just do the same thing. It will search based on -lfoo for a libfoo.a or libfoo.so. And where will it search for that? In the location specified by the -L option. So the way we use static and shared libraries to a first approximation, once we've created them, looks the same. And the compiler will just choose between them for us. There's a caveat here, and it's going to be ugly. But before I get to that, questions on our shared library creation process and linking, basic linking. So if you looked at this naively, you'd assume, well, I pass -L path to lib. So when my program runs, it's going to look in path to lib and load libfoo.so. Right, that's what you'd expect. And I think that's a very reasonable expectation, which is not what Linux does. The -l option only sets the path to use when creating the executable. When it's running, there's a completely separate set of locations that are searched for libfoo.so. And this means that we'll have this scenario where we can create an executable and it won't run. So in my example here, I have a directory with my libexample.so and main.c. And my directory isn't one of the ones the system administrator has set as the default. So when I try to make main from main.c with the libexample.so, it tells me, oh, I don't know where that file is, that library is, because it's looking for libexample.so in these normal locations. It's not in a normal location. It's just this random directory I'm working in. So what I can do is I can tell Clang, OK, look in the current directory for the library with the -L option. I'm specifying a dot. Dot, remember, means current directory. And it works. Clang uses the library, doesn't complain, just makes our main executable. And then I try to run it, and I get this error. Oh, couldn't open libexample.so. And the problem is that I told Clang where to look for the library, but I still need to tell main where to look for the library, and Clang does not automatically tell main. And this kind of actually does make sense, because you might want to have libraries in a different place when you're building an application than when you're running it. So these options are decoupled. Maybe it doesn't make sense that they're decoupled by default. Maybe that shouldn't be the default, but it is. So what can we do to get this library to actually, you know, be found when we run main? And there's kind of two ways. So one way is we can set something before we run main, telling the system, in addition to the places you normally look for libraries, look in the current directory. Another option is that there is, in fact, a way to tell Clang to embed the place to look for the library in the executable. So this shows both of those options. So this so we can run the program in a way where, as we run it, we say look in dot for libraries. That's what this LD library path setting does on Linux. We can run this command here, export LD library path equals dot, to set for the rest of our SSH session the place to look for libraries, including dot. And then everything we run, it will search for .so files and dot in addition to all the other locations. Or we can use this rpath option to embed the location dot in the executable as the runtime place to search. Rpath stands for runtime path. Questions on these options for making it so we can actually load our library when the application starts? Yes, back there.
If you do the last option where you have rpath, will it also look in the normal locations?
If I do the last option where I have rpath, will it also look in the normal locations? Yes. So all these options kind of extend the default locations. Other questions? Yeah.
What's the
WL? That is part of the way of setting rpath. So question is, why is it capital WL? So this means, the WL part means pass to linker, and then this is the thing to pass to the, and the rpath is the thing to pass to the linker. So internally, the way Clang works is Clang isn't actually a linker, it's running a linker. And you're telling it how to run it with this option. Other questions? Okay. So another notable thing about using libraries that's a common error people make is because it's a common error because it doesn't always break things, but you should generally put libraries at the end of your executable producing command. And the reason for this is the linker processes things in order. So if you put lname at the beginning, what the linker might do is it might say, okay, here's a library, let me see what things from it I should include in the executable. And it will say, oh, nothing matched. Okay, let's move on to the next thing. And it will never figure out by default that it needs to actually include any part of that library in your program. If you put it last, it will figure out, oh, I'm missing these things, it's in the library, and it will include it. And what makes this extra confusing is that this is usually only a problem for static libraries and not shared ones. Just because the linker handles looking for them and things differently. It does shared libraries mostly when the program runs and static libraries mostly when it's processing each file on the command line. So questions here? Okay, so let's do a little exercise. Going back to simpler things. So we talked about building libraries. We're gonna go back to just building programs. So let's say I have a program which is exactly this running example I had before. Oh, maybe I'll do this version of it. And my question is, let's say I change main.c, what commands should I rerun? And the same thing for extra.h. I'll give you like a minute. Check with your neighbor, see if you agree. We'll see what we do. I can show it, but not at the same time. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so let's see for main.c changing. Who thinks we should rerun command 1? Thinks we should rerun command 2? Who thinks we should rerun command 3? Okay, so we have a plurality on 1 and 3. How about question B, if extra database changes? Who thinks we should rerun command 1? Who thinks we should rerun command 2? Thinks we should rerun command 3. Okay, so here we have a 1 plus 2 plus 3 and 2 plus 3 split. So for A, if main.c changes, that affects main.o. It doesn't affect extra.o. If we go back to our picture here, right, we have main.c changed, and we can kind of follow this forward and say, okay, I need to rebuild main.o and program. In the case of extra.h changing, I can say extra.h changed, I can follow this forward, I need to rebuild main.o, I also need to rebuild extra.o, and the reason why is that they both were generated by reading extra.h. You might say, but extra.h doesn't contain any machine code or anything that should generate machine code. And well, this is kind of true, right? There's probably no functions that are defined in extra.h. It's just declarations. But if we change how a function is declared, that can like change how we have to call it. And that would change the machine code that's in main.o. Therefore, we have to rebuild main.o just in case, because how the functions are called may have changed. Question?
So if you don't update main.o, and it's using old and extra.h, and that was previously functioning, but we change extra.h now, we up update extra.o, right? How could that possibly cause a problem if v.o is still functional and there is no changes to machine code, if it's still being called properly within itself?
So the question is, how could we have an incompatibility if we update, if we forget to update main.o? So there's changes we can make to extra.h that will change the assembly that ends up in main.o. So as an example, let's say in extra.h, I had a function foo that takes a float and in version 1, and in version 2, this function foo takes an int. I might have a call to it that still works, but the assembly code's going to be different, right? So in the x86-64 calling convention, the main assembly code for calling foo is going to move something into XMM0, because that's where the calling convention says floating point arguments go. And in the other version, it's going to move something into ESI, because that's where an integer argument goes. So what will happen is when we rebuild the executable without making this change, in this case, we will call foo, and foo will have junk where it expects its argument, and probably that will result in some very weird behavior. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yeah, back there. Yes?
Yeah, okay. I was curious about the question. You said that there was extra.c changes, but it only be
extra.3. Question, would it be only 2 and 3 if extra.c changed instead of extra.h? Yes. Other questions? Okay, yeah. So the question is, what would happen if main.h changed? We have to rebuild extra.o? No, because it doesn't include it. Okay, so we can figure out what needs to run by hand, but this process is both tedious and error-prone. So we're going to be teaching you a tool that tries to help automate this, which is in a family of tools that are out there. But we're going to teach you Make, which is probably the oldest one and a very flexible one, which is a program for making things based on what things have changed. And Make is just an automation for running commands. Make doesn't know about how compilers work. It just knows about running commands and looking at when files were modified. And what commands does it run? That's going to be based on what we'll call rules that are in a file we call a makefile. The file is called a makefile, and that is, in fact, the file name of the file. It's going to be literally makefile, no extension. And the rules are going to be text that looks like this. So we have these rules that specify how to create a file. So in this example, I'm specifying to create the file main.o. What you should do is you should run this command here, clang minus wall minus c main.c. So that's enough to create main.o, but we need to know when do we create main.o. And for that purpose, we have prerequisites. So after our colon, we specify the files that are used to create main.o. So I'm telling Make that when you run this command, it's going to use these files to do its thing and update main.o. And a syntax note here, this arrow here represents a tab. And because Make is old, and they made some unfortunate decisions in the 70s, 80s, that has to be an actual tab character, not 8 spaces, an actual tab. And you will need to figure out how to make your text editor generate a real tab and not spaces there. work. Won't work. I'm sure this is a decision they regret, but it's been like 40 years, so they can't really change it now. But anyways, we have these rules which tell us, here's how we make main.o, here's the things we need to make main.o, and make will read these rules, and if you ask make to create main.o, it will do it by running that command, but it won't always run the command. It's going to check all the prerequisites, all the things that are listed after the colon, and see, did any of these things actually change? And if the answer is no, it just does nothing. It just says, no work to do, and saves you some time. If any of those things did change, then it runs the command. So questions about our make rule. Okay. And there's one caveat here, is that make is recursive. So make's actually going to check to see, is there a rule telling me how to generate, say, main.c? So it's going to look for something that says main.c in some command. Now, probably for main.c, we wouldn't have such a thing. But this functionality is useful because there are cases where it really does make sense to have additional rules and to have basically chains of rules. So here I have a rule for program, and what make's going to do if I ask it to create program, it is first going to check, well, are main.o and extra.o up to date? And to do that, it's not just going to check the modification time of main.o, it's going to check main.o's rule. It's going to run main.o's rule first and extra.o's rule. So it runs main.o's rule and checks, is main.c more recent than main.o? If so, I need to run this command first before I move on. So it's going to be recursive, and we can have these kind of chains of rules. So we specify our rules basically one file at a time, but when we ask make to build a file, it's going to go through the whole set of files, figure out how they react together, and run the commands in an order that makes sense based on how they depend on each other. Questions? This idea of chain of rules. So we have our make file. How do we actually run it? So the way make works is I have these rules. You just have a file that lists all the rules. That's a text file called a make file. And if it's in the current directory, then you can run make and target. And what do we expect target? There's going to be some rule that says target colon something. Make's going to look for that rule and do what that rule says. So it's going to check the dependent prerequisites. If the target is older than those prerequisites, it's going to run the commands, and it's going to do this recursively. So if their prerequisites have rules of themselves, they're going to get run first, and so on. We can also specify multiple targets, and we also have the example I showed you Tuesday where I just typed make. How did that work? If I don't specify a target, it's just whatever's first in the make file. So by convention, we'll put like the program first. That's why in my example here, I had program at the top. And so questions on invoking make. Okay, so next time we'll do a little exercise. We'll start off with this exercise here. We definitely do not have enough time to go through it routine.